I had a grammar school basketball coach. His name was Danny Monahan. And he was the first person that ever turned to me and said, do you want to be great? Not do you want to be good? Do you want to be something? You know, this is New York. This is the real deal, fellas. Do you want to be great? And he was the first guy that ever asked me that question. You don't ever turn on your own people. You stay with them. And that was dangerous that day. And we could have died that day. But I learned that day also, you don't ever turn your back on people. You don't ever run from people. You stay there. It's hard. It sucks. And at 16 years old, I lost him. And that's why I became a basketball coach. But I never ran, and I never turned from him. And that's why I can look myself in a mirror these days.
What's up, y'all? Welcome back to Ship Across the Border. My name is Max. I'm here with Chris. And today we have on a very, very special guest. Thank you for your time, Coach Sutter from Westfield State.
So before we get into this, I'm going to quickly break down who Coach Sutter is and how he got here. So quick few highlights from the Westfield State basketball page is he was a MASCAC Coach of the Year for 2021-2022. He has a all-time record of 338 and 266, which is a win percentage of 560. He had his 300th win against Amherst College, and he's an amazing coach. He coaches for Westfield State, which is like 30 minutes away from us. I shot him an email, and that's how this got set up.
Some other notable things is a former Division I player for St. Bonaventure's University, assistant coach at Division I Colgate, and we're blessed with that. He kind of decided to respond to Chris's email and is here with us today.
Yeah, so to start off, I just want to break down, like, where did you grow up? How did we start playing basketball and your journey to where you got today?
So again, thank you for the invite. Thanks for having me. And I think this is really cool what you're doing. And so that's one of the reasons I came down here today and been here a bunch of times to play games before. So
got his first win at Elms.
When you said McGuire Center, that made it a lot easier for me. When you said library, I was like, not sure I've ever been there, but I do know that I've been in a McGuire Center.
So where you got your first win, right?
This is where I got my first collegiate win against Our Lady of the Elms. Paul Scoville was the coach back then, and that's 25 years ago. So I didn't want to. You took some of that stuff off my website, and I have 369 wins, actually. Somebody reminded me the other day. It was a little higher than the total you gave me. But the 3, the 6, and the 9, I don't know if you guys know that, but that represents Tesla.
Yep.
Tesla's theory in the whole thing of the universe was 3, 6, and 9. So I feel like that a little bit in coaching right now. You know, I feel like pretty good about things and where our program's at. And basketball on the Division I level has taken a really wild turn. And I just think I'm so glad that 25 years ago I decided to kind of go Division III and get into that philosophy, because it's been really comfortable for me. And now the way things are breaking up there, I think it's a whole lot better for me down here.
Is there, think there's more stability in kind of Division III?
Sure, sure. I was able to coach for 25 years, and I was able to coach the basketball team the way I wanted to. Mm-hmm. Division I has all sorts of constraints and pressures. And I was at Division I. Thankfully, I worked for a great gentleman, Jack Bruin, at Colgate, who was an absolute saint. And somehow he never really wore those pressures too much, because sometimes as an assistant coach, pressure from the head coach gets moved downhill, and then it gets moved to you. And that can make things really uncomfortable. And Jackie Bruin was a saint of a gentleman and a really good guy to work for. And our success there was attributed to the fact that the guy I do our podcast with and our television show, it's called In the Zone, Pete Coles, and he says UConn's loose. He's not a great basketball guy, but he just started watching with me this year since we've been doing the show, and he says, they're just loose. And I think that's a great descriptor, and I think that's kind of like the way things were back in the day a little bit. Things were a little looser.
So the first question we kind of have was, do you feel pressure to win from fans, alumni, administration? And as you talked about, there is some pressure there, especially at Division I level. But at that Division III level, I'm sure that there is still some. So how do you kind of deal with that?
It's a great question. I think that most of my pressure is internal. You know, I put it on myself.
100%. I work for
a really good athletic director. Our administration, the presidents that we've had, have been very good and supportive of everything that I've been doing there. We've been successful, so that keeps a little bit of the heat, you know, off of you, you know, if you can be successful. But the main thing is I've been able to do things my way and what I consider to be at least the right way. Because as you asked before, I grew up in the Bronx and I started playing basketball at a really young age. And the whole thing of basketball to me was like religion. You know, I grew up in a Catholic parish, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar would come play in our schoolyard because we had a great schoolyard there. It was insane, the basketball. If you lost on Saturday, you'd sit for like 3 hours just to get back in that next game. That's how intense it was. And I remember being an altar boy, and I was looking out on the stage with the priest, and we were looking out into the church, and at 11 o'clock, that's the big time mass that they would have for the parish. And he'd look out there, and it was kind of empty, you know, and he looked back at me, and he said, you know, I could never really be sure who's in first place in this parish, God or basketball. And I didn't want to hurt his feelings, but I said, Father, if you're late on Saturday, you sit like Jonah in the belly of the whale. I said, but if you're late on Sunday, you can still always find a seat. And it killed the priest when I told him that. But that's where we grew up. It was a basketball mecca. It was, if you couldn't make a left-hand layup in the third grade, you were done in life.
Really? Have you ever had an altercation with a fan or with somebody where they sort of got mad at you or something because of a loss you just had or a game you just had?
Altercations with fans, Division III, you know, they're like right on top of you. You know, it's not like Division I where there's some of that good separation. So I haven't had any altercations, but my wife got struck with a bottle one time, a plastic bottle one time at Springfield College. We've had some other things where there's been some different stuff. But by and large, you know, I think we've been lucky. You know, we haven't had, I certainly wouldn't want to get into any altercations with any fans or anything like that. That's not appropriate. Mm-hmm. You see what's going on the Division I level now with the Garden and Danny Hurley yakking at some fans and stuff. That's not for me. Mm-hmm. That's not for me because I have 15, 16, 17, however many people are on my roster, they're also under my charge. And I started out in this business as a physical education teacher. And the first thing you learn as a physical education teacher is to create a safe environment. And if I'm out there yakking and talking and creating an unsafe environment for my players around me with 500, 1,000 opposing fans in the stands, then I'm not creating a safe environment for my players. And that's the first rule of coaching to me.
You brought up your early career there. I want to ask, in terms of your evolution as a coach, did you feel the pressure more in your beginning of your career, or has it been pretty steady throughout the whole time you've been coaching basketball?
I think it's gotten worse as I've gotten older.
Really?
Yeah, because you look at yourself in terms of a clock almost, you know, like I'm 63 years old. I've been coaching for 25 years at Westfield State, but I've been coaching for over 40 years total. It'd be ridiculous to say I'm on the front nine, right? So you want to keep things in perspective. And so as I've gotten older and then time now has become just that little bit more prevalent in the back of my brain, you know, I say I want to win. I want to do something really special before it ends. And so maybe that's where the pressure comes from. But as I said before, the pressure has always been more intense internally from myself than it has been from anybody externally.
So kind of relating to that pressure thing, our next question is like, how do you define success beyond just like winning and losing your coaching career?
Graduation rate.
I got a good one.
I got a good one. My graduation rate's better than my basketball winning percentage.
That's awesome.
We're way, way up in the 95 percentile as far as graduation. It's one of the reasons I wanted to be a Division III coach, and that's exactly how I measure myself as a basketball coach. Not wins and losses. It's what we do when we bring them into the process, what happens to them in our process, and then what happens to them when they walk across that stage and then get ready to move 100%. On to life.
What are some things that you're doing with your players to sort of push them in the direction of that graduation rate or lessons that you're instilling in them?
I'll be very honest. Post-COVID, it's been much more difficult, you know, especially with class attendance and just a lot of different things in general. But one of the things that's always been the staple of our program is you have to go to class if you want to play basketball. And so if we find out that there's some real bad class attendance problems or there's just some neglect going on there by the student, you know, that's what I have the bench for. That's my motivation. And so that's what we use it for.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that you set out to do when you got to Westfield State, that you wanted to see the graduation go up and that's how you were going to try and build this program?
I think when I came to Westfield State, I grew up in New York my whole life. This was really the first time, except for when I was at Colgate, we played Harvard a couple of different times. It was only really only time I had been in Massachusetts my entire life. When I came in here, I said, what would be the smart play? And I said, the smart play would be to act like you're a guest, because I am a guest. So if you go and take somebody's player as a coach, high school coach, and then I don't treat him well, he doesn't graduate, I cut him, I do stuff to him that's not what the coach and I discussed when we were having our discussions in the recruitment process, where everything's always very flowery and good and all that other stuff. And then it comes down to, okay, now we're going to have to pick 7, 8 guys to play. And so that's the piece of it that I always knew. I was a guest in this state. And so you, if you upset one person, you've upset two, three, four, five. And so I always wanted to at least play it as straight as I could with the players. When we're recruiting somebody, we're recruiting them because we think they can play. And when they're here, if they take care of their business with us as far as going to the weight room, doing the classroom work, doing that good stuff, then we're going to use them and we're going to play them as well too, as much as we can.
That's really interesting, because one of the things that we've really preached on this podcast is the idea that, like, outside of basketball, you could be the most skilled player in the world, but if your grades are garbage and you're a terrible person off the court, it's going to be very hard for you to play at the college level, because no coach wants to have a kid like that that's under their team.
100%. I think that kind of parlays into our next question, which is, like, what's your plan for recruiting for this coming offseason, and what weaknesses to your team are you looking to address?
That's,
and maybe it's
question.
Also personalities, and maybe it's not on the court necessarily type stuff.
Yeah. The personality piece is a lot larger with me than you would think. You know, right now, because I've been in this business for 40 plus years, I really pick up the phone with people I know and trust, coaches I know and trust, to do my initial recruiting. So I'm going to call Jerry Quinn from St. Thomas More. I'm going to call Mike McCleary down at Archbishop Molloy, people that I've worked with, people that I know. Because right now it's really hard to get good intel on players. Everybody tells you, oh, he's the best thing since sliced bread, and then they come into the gym and it's not that way at all. And so right now I want to really work as hard as I can in this process to be really productive and to be proactive to find the right players for our program. Coming into this year, we return about 10 or 11 players to this year's team coming in. And so I feel pretty good about our base. We're not looking for a big class this year, but we're always looking to bring in a balanced class, meaning positionally. You know, we want to bring in some bigs. We want to bring in some forwards. We want to get a good point guard. You know, right now, point guard might be our, if you ask me what's our biggest need, I'd say a backup point guard or another person to compete at the point would be somebody that we could use there. But, you know, always looking to be balanced, always looking to grow. And what we've tried to do at Westfield, and this is what the portal has upset at the D1 level, this is what the NIL has upset at the D1 level, what we've tried to do is maintain program integrity. Seniors rule, juniors are coming up next, sophomores are in there, and the freshmen are learning and getting their time. But that's, you know, we've had freshmen of the year in our program, so if you're a good enough freshman, we are going to play you. But we also realize that that first year is critical infrastructure to getting that foundation laid 100%. For the rest of your time in school.
100%.
Sort of building on top of that, what are some things that if you were looking to the high school level, you'd be looking for in a player that you're recruiting outside of athleticism and skill?
So when, especially now, when players want to be recruited or there's some interaction between the coach and the player, it's a little easier right now to initially do that because you can get film. And you can get clips. But the clips are, if I clipped up both of you guys right now, we could find some good clips. Yeah. You know, you want to take me in the gym, I'm 63 years old, I'll make a couple of jumpers. I'll get you a backdoor pass. You know, we can all, you know, clip it up and look good. Mm-hmm. And if I said to one of my coaches one time, because they were big into the clips and all this other stuff, and I said, and I took the player on our team who was the absolute worst player on our team, and I said, if you took a clip of him during the entire season in practice, would you come up with a good film? He's like, yeah, sure. He's had some decent days. You know, he's made some shots. Exactly. So I don't want to see the clips anymore. I like to see the whole game. I want to see the person's demeanor. And I also want to see what happens when he gets taken out of the game, because we do take people out of the game. And for us, body language is huge 100%. As far as that goes. If you have an issue with coming out of the game, at that public moment is not the real time to display that, to display that dissatisfaction. It makes you into a bad teammate. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do is have guys who we can watch on film and say he got it as a high school, because the best predictor of the future is the past, right? You look at what somebody did in high school, and if he's throwing the towel, throwing the water bottle, cursing out his teammates, cursing out one of the coaches, we don't want him. We don't want him because he's going to do the same thing here.
Yeah, he's going to poison the well.
That's not always easy to find that out, but that's where we spend a good amount of our time.
Are you big on going to actually watch in person your recruits games?
I don't think – there's been a few because they've been really, really far out of state. But we will also have our gym open, playing while guys visit and doing stuff. We're not really watching that too closely. But we do get some good feedback from our guys. But I couldn't imagine having a lot of players come into your program. That's one of the reasons our roster is based in Massachusetts as much as it is, without going to see somebody playing live. Yeah. I really want to get out there because there's a vibration to basketball. 100%. And there's a vibration to the way that we play at Westfield, and we want to know that we share that same vibration before we get down the road.
What type of system do you guys, or what is your, I guess, coaching kind of philosophy, offensively, defensively?
We'll start on the defensive side of the ball.
For what you can share, obviously, we're not going to give away your coaching secrets for anyone.
I'll start on the defensive side of the ball because this year we were first in block shots entire nation, and we were second in rebounding in the entire nation.
Was that intentional? Like you preach those things to your
team? It's always intentional. You just don't always wind up in first place. Yeah. You know, and that, you know, you get a plaque for something like that. It's a fairly nice award. It's something like that. But we, in this day and age still, to this day, because I think that's where I am stronger as a coach, really stress defense, really try and get after it on the defensive end. If I get a really, really good defensive unit that's given me what I want on the defensive end, the hard stuff. You guys both played ball, right? Charges, diving on the floor for loose balls, those little things that you look for as a coach, not everybody's willing to do, you know? And so you get that and you say, okay, this guy's willing and he's in there. And so you look for those little things and those intangibles as well, too. So when I get that type of team, I want to kind of be free with them offensively as a reward. You know, I'm not going to bog them down with a million plays. I'm not going to go wild with every time. And I've watched different coaches that I know and different philosophies. It's one of the things I love to do is watch other coaches coach their game and their team and see what they do. And then I pick up some different things there that I might want to do, might not want to do, and move from there. But it's always good to watch other coaches interact with their team because you'll see, yourself a little bit if you look close enough.
Are there a few defensive principles that you try and stress in practice? Because like last year at Madai, our coach was really big on not jumping on any pump fakes, pushing everyone baseline, and his like super simple system. He made it very easy for us to remember what was going on. Because if you can remember five simple principles, that was like you could cover the whole defense. And even if you forgot exactly the play that we were doing, as long as you stuck to those five principles, you could be effective defensively. So do you have something like that you teach your players?
I think every coach has stuff like that. I'll give you mine in a nutshell. Don't get beat off the dribble. Mm-hmm. Don't get beat off the dribble with the strong hand. If we can eliminate those two things, we're going to be bad. What happens when you get beat off the dribble?
Someone's going to step in.
Your defense collapses. Help, recovers. You know, good passer is going to be able to slice and dice from there, and you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And so the first thing we do with our defense is please don't get beat off the dribble. Don't get scorched. Mm-hmm. You know, now if you're coming off a double screen, you know, and you get clipped on the double screen and the guy catches it and breaks and penetrates a little bit, that's a little bit different. But if the point guard takes it and he goes right at it and we go boom, 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 and he's in the paint, we got problems. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first mantra of our defense is to create the paint as if it's our sanctuary. Nobody gets in there. The cutter doesn't get in there. The ball doesn't get in there. We do games in practice, too, where if the ball touches the paint at any time, the play's over and it costs a point. Yeah, so you do some of that stuff just to insist and enforce that that's our core. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to I've listened to a lot of coaches about a lot of this stuff. When it comes to forcing baseline or doing this stuff, if you make your players on defense think too much, you're gonna cripple them. Mm-hmm. Okay, you want to have them aggressive. So if somebody in our defense goes for a steal and doesn't get it, we're not really too upset about that. Now you say don't leave your feet. Yeah, that's kind of traditional, but you don't lead the country in block shots if you don't leave your feet once in a while. So you got to take some chances too. We try and get our guys to wait till the opponent leaves his feet, then you leave your feet. Mm-hmm. So what I don't like to do with defense is create all of these absolutes. You're forcing him this way. Well, what if he goes that way?
It is.
And once you confuse your players, they're no longer aggressive. Once you confuse your players and have them start grinding and thinking, what does coach want me to do? I remember, I say to my players all the time, my entire high school career, I played for two fairly vocal high school coaches. And I don't remember listening to them at all when I was out on the floor. If they stopped the game or had something to say to me, yes, coach, yes, sir, I want you to get back on defense, Sutter. Okay, coach, I'm going to get back on defense. But while that game was going on, while that ball was lit, I was trained and instructed from the time I was 5 years old, you don't listen to nobody. You don't talk to your mom. You don't talk to your girlfriend. You don't ask anybody for a piece of gum. You're on layup line. Your focus is in between those lines. Nothing outside of that lines matters. And that's what I try and instill with my players really, really hard these days, you know, especially D3, where the crowd can just walk right up. We've had people walk right up in our huddle, you know.
So would you say you're definitely not a very vocal coach then, like in terms of when things are going poorly?
I played for a high school coach who once said this, and I thought it was very salient and empowering. He says, I'm never going to publicly embarrass you. And I try and do that with my players. I don't need to scream and go crazy at my players. Obviously, we play in noisy gyms, and it gets a little crazy in there sometimes. If anybody saw our game when we played Worcester State for the championship at that place, they couldn't hear a sound. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been in Elm's gym when they have the top all lit up there and everybody's rocking and rolling and it's difficult to hear anything. So being a vocal coach is great, but there's going to be moments where that disappears on you. And so how I approach games is I think I'm a professor. You know, I don't have a PhD, but I think I'm a professor. And at that moment, I'm giving an exam. Mm-hmm. And I want to find out the knowledge of my players. And if I've done a good job coaching them, I shouldn't need to say a whole lot during that game. Up and screaming and going at players and grabbing people and doing that stuff, that's not for me. Throwing chairs. I watched Bobby Knight when I grew up, and I just didn't see that was me. That wasn't for me.
Mm-hmm. So you've you have been a part of a very successful program that you've kind of built from the ground up for the last 25 years, and you've been a part of very successful other programs at different levels. What are kind of the ingredients that you think make a successful basketball team, on and off the court, in practice, everything that goes into it?
Relationships are huge. I'll give you an example. When we signed O'Donnell Foyle at Colgate, we made a promise to the people that were around O'Donnell that we would go out and we would play a schedule that was absolutely first-notch schedule. So we played Allen Iverson at Georgetown. We wound up playing Maryland. We wound up playing Syracuse every single year, St. John's down in New York. And they were always away games. You never get anybody to play you at home, you know. And so when we did that, though, I got a chance to look at our team a little bit. And we were like, one year, and we wound up winning the Patriot League, wound up going to the NCAA tournament for the first time.
They won the Patriot League this year, too.
Right? They've won it four in a row now. But we were the first people ever to do it in school history. And when we took over, they were 1-25. Matt Langell's kind of benefited from having Jack Bruin as the head coach before him. But Coach Bruin set that precedent when we signed O'Donnell Foyle that we would go out. We went out, we were like 1-11 before we got to the Patriot League. And that team was beat up. That team was worn out. And we wound up being successful and getting to the top of it. But I also, you know, in scheduling and other places, you want to have your team feel good about itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's part of it with coaching, with scheduling, and making sure that you have requisite time in between games, they get rested. So, because the Marines have a saying that fatigue makes cowards of us all. And if you get a tired basketball team, you're going to have a tough time with them on defense. You're going to have a tough time with getting them to run the floor as hard as you want them to.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm curious about is, as a leader, I've listened to a lot of podcasts on business and stuff like that. And one of the concepts I've heard is that when you're a leader, there's three things you can do when you want someone to do something that you're trying to get them to do. So it's like you can reward, you can ignore, and you can extinguish. So if you reward them for something, it means you want to see them do that again. If you punish them, then they're not going to do that again. If you ignore it, it's just like letting it be. Have you tried to consciously do something like that with your players on the court? So if someone comes down and they do they have a terrible pass, they jump off one foot, they get a charge or something, do you consciously bring effort towards the idea of punishing them, rewarding them, or just ignoring that problem altogether?
I think as I've gotten older, ignore became a better philosophy. I was a little more confrontational when I was younger. I wanted things my way. And I think maybe that, you know, you got to be a little confrontational to be a basketball coach. Mm-hmm. I think the really good ones are a little bit sociopathical. A little 100%. Bit too. 100%. You know, there's just a little bit of gear there that some of those guys have that, you know, it's just, and so much of that's been extinguished with the way the game has changed and the way people have changed, and people want, you know, parents don't want their sons and daughters talked to like that. And so you have to pick your spots, you know, but you can't ignore everything.
Yeah.
You know, but you have to pick your spots. The biggest thing that I've learned to do is it's really, really primal. Sometimes when you get into a gymnasium, and if you think of it like that, you know, it really you become a better basketball coach. Let me explain what I'm talking about. The primal aspect of it is the minute that I start to praise one of my players, all the others turn on him. Mm-hmm. Whether they voice it, whether they say it, whether their language shows it or not, they all turn on him. Mm-hmm. Okay, so when my praise comes out, it has to be collective. I want to praise. I want to be good with that. I want to throw a lot of compliments around, but it has to be collective. The minute I single one of them out, you would think it would make the others want to run a little faster and go a little higher. It doesn't. It makes them feel like they're being torn down. And so that's a piece of it that's really, really important for me. The second piece of it is when I'm communicating with somebody, I can communicate to the entire group when I'm talking to one person. I may have a guy that's not playing as hard on defense as I want him to, you know? And so I can talk to the whole group about that. But if everybody else is doing the right thing and there's only one person doing the wrong thing, that's where the bench comes in. That's where you have to motivate by not playing that person, because otherwise your program integrity goes away. The minute you start playing somebody who's not doing what the coaches want, everybody stops doing what the coaches want. And so you got to have that fine line and walk it through. But my communication style is much more private these days. If I have to be critical, if I have to be critical of somebody, I'm going to do it one-on-one. I'm not going to pull them in front of the whole team and go, hey, John, you know, you missed 14 shots in a row. Why do you keep shooting threes? You know, A, I want him to keep shooting them because I know those next 14 might go in and he's going to wind up being 500. But the second piece of it is I would walk across to him first because I learned this a long time ago in New York. You don't ever know what's going on in somebody's life. You don't know.
100%.
You don't know what that day was like for that person. You don't know what it was like when they lost their parent. You don't know what it was like, what that impact was like. I take that philosophy with me every step of the way that I go in life, especially with my players. When I'm talking to one of them, why are we having this behavior? Why is this coming up? What's popping up? What's going on? You know, and then often you have a conversation one-on-one on the bleachers, and all of a sudden it's, coach, you know, today's the day my dad passed away, you know, and it's always been a hard day for me, and I'm sorry, you know. And then now you're at the root because then you can do something. But if you just stay at the top on the flower, you ain't going to be able to help that person. And so you got to be able to figure out, like, it really, really changes from, you know, perspective, you know, into what a broader mindset, you know. And then once you take that broader mindset of, what are you two guys going through to do this podcast today? That's why I was 15 minutes early. Maybe you guys got a little jammed up. What's somebody else doing? And when I sit there and I say, man, I'm having a rough day here. Somebody pops up in my view, some lady who used to walk up the stairs in my gym building to go to class, who had a cane and couldn't normally get up the stairs, and we didn't have the proper ramps and all the other stuff that we should have had for her back in 1998, you know? And then I look at myself and I go, man, what's wrong with you? You know, get yourself together, you know? Everybody's got problems. And there's a great saying, and I'll share it with you guys because you're young and you should know this. If everybody in the world took all their problems and threw them into one pile, you would gladly go up to that pile and take your own problems back.
The amount of times that I've came in, let's just say I didn't get in or we got blown out and I got at the end of the game and I got opportunity and I shot one and I missed it and I'm like frustrated after the game. The amount of times that Chris has said that exact same line to me, that kind of just snaps, because everything, when something, like obviously I care about that more than other people around me, and so you're very zoomed in to the experiences that you hold close to your heart. And so sure, it's very difficult to kind of get separation and look at it through a different perspective other than negativity when something, I guess, impacts that. And that, I feel like that phrase, whenever Chris says that to me, is a very good demagnifier and helps you kind of get separation from it. Look at something for what it really is. At the end of the day, I miss a shot in a collegiate basketball game and I'm blessed to be a part of the program and to have gotten in. And I feel like you can take that and apply it to so many different aspects of life.
So much of it is also proportionality. Okay, right now, in that moment, this means everything to you, you know, and somebody gave you a little bit more perspective of what's the whole thing look like.
Exactly.
And so then it becomes a little easier.
The goal isn't to get into the game and make one shot. The goal is to maybe use this game to get the game reps and the experience and the feeling of adjusting to the speed. To then next year I can come in and I can have a consistent play drawn up for me to shoot the ball. And like, that's really the end goal.
I'm going to help you right now. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to help you right now. I'm going to put on my coaching hat. I'm going to help you. I'm going to give you a story. Okay. There was a guy who went to the University of Michigan and they weren't giving him no love as quarterback. They had some dudes all over the place. They got guys lined up. Tom Brady was his name, you know? And so he was all up in his own head. And one of the coaches, again, pulled him aside, said, Tom, what's going on? And he says, man, I get like 3 reps a day. How am I going to show anybody 3 reps a day? What am I going to show? Guy says, okay. So we want you to go see this counselor. This guy is a sports psychologist. We want you to go talk to this guy. He's in our program. You go speak to this guy. So he goes and he speaks to this counselor, and the counselor says, so what's going on, Tom? He says, well, I only get 3 reps. All the other quarterbacks get all these reps to show how good they can do. How can I show how good I can be? He said, well, how many reps do you get, Tom? He says, I get like 3 to 5. He said, turn those 3 to 5 into your Super Bowl. Then 3 to 5 changes to 10. 3 to 5 changes to 20. Mm-hmm. 3 to 5 changes to 6 Super Bowl rings. Mm-hmm.
100%.
One of the things that he was talking about there, like when he came back in the room, when he was really like bogged down and couldn't figure out what was going on, I tried to like sort of zoom out for him. And realistically, we just went over the math and we broke it down. It's like you only had, I think it was something like 7 shots throughout the whole season.
Well,
The whole season. I was like, well, if you think about it realistically, you may be like,
I'm a 3-point, like my game is, I'm a 3-point shooter. If I'm getting put in the game, it's to make shots.
But he didn't make any shots. But I was like, well, if you zoom out, it's like, it's only 10 shots. It's like, you just expand the sample size. Eventually one's going to fall. Like, it's such a small sample size of things that are going on. It's, you're so zoomed into what's going on in that moment. If you
when
zoom
you're looking
out,
at a small sample size, it becomes more difficult
100%.
To go. So if you're coming in and getting one shot, you know, and that one shot is every shot, that becomes that one shot. That's why you get magnified, and that's where 100%. You start getting swallowed up inside yourself.
100%.
Okay, let me tell you another story. All right, I did not play with the 3-point line when I was playing basketball. It wasn't there. Mm-hmm. We didn't have shot clocks either. Okay, but the 3-point line was really big because later on in life I kept playing, and I would go to these men's leagues with my guys, and we'd play against former pros and play against everybody in New York. We'd go anywhere to play anywhere against anybody. We loved playing hoops, right? Then they put the 3-point line in, and I became a completely different basketball player. I became less of a basketball player when that line went in because I stopped being me. That's what that line did. And so as much as you say, I'm a shooter, mm-hmm. you've just put yourself into a basket where you're going to have a good game every once in a while. Mm-hmm. You know, you would go and start to approach it in your manifestation of what you think you are, approach it from something that happens a lot more out on the court than you taking a 3-pointer mm-hmm. because that's 1-2 possessions. 100%. That's why I tell my guys all the time, get inside, fit into all the other stuff 100%. In basketball. Because you can help a team so many different ways in college basketball.
So something that I do personally that kind of relates to that. So after every time I play basketball, especially on the times where I go and I play shit, is I write down like 10 things that I did well. And so whether that's, and me and Chris have talked to him because he's watched a bunch of the practices because although he's not playing, he's still involved in our program. And he'll be like, yo, you set a good screen. You set a really good screen that freed up someone for a shot. And like there's these little things that you may not think, oh, I did nothing. I had a terrible day today. But there are these little things like obviously I'm out there. I'm a good basketball player. I'm of the collegiate level, and so I'm contributing to my team. And there are things that I'm not even putting emphasis on that are positive things, that are very positive things that help the team contribute to wins. Another thing that I'm actually doing that we're talking about is like the sample size and thing like that is, so this entire offseason, I've kind of committed to myself of every time I play 5-on-5 full court basketball, I'm tracking my percentages from three. So, and I'm writing them down in a journal. And so ideally, I go back at the end of the summer after I've played in open gyms throughout the whole fall, go home, I play pickup, I'm playing in 2 or 3 really high-level summer men's leagues at home, and I'll be able to, it'll help me zoom out. So for example, one open gym last week, I went like 0 for 10 from 3, and I jot that down. But then, and I'm obviously feeling not good about myself, and well, I can't shoot, all these negative thoughts going back to your head, but then you go and look at this book with has all my percentages, and I was feeling like, oh, let me see what I'm shooting, and I just went 0 for 11. I'm still shooting 35% on the off season so far, which is not where I want to be, but respectable. So it really helps me zoom out and kind of, like Chris was saying before, look in bigger sample sizes. Because at the end of the day, I can shoot. And if I shoot enough shots, a good percentage of them.
Shooting's the most measurable thing that you can improve and get better at. You know, you have some people now in college basketball shooting 50% from 3-point range.
100%.
You know, those are snipers. But I always tell my guys, and I say this to them, we used to have a saying back home in the Bronx because we didn't have the 3-point line, obviously, but we in Westchester County or other places you would go to play, there was much more jump shot oriented. We were at 94 feet. Get it to the rim, let's go. And so it was a little, and so we used to have a saying that we used to, you know, when we like to say to people, if you live by the jump shot, you will die by the jump shot. Mm-hmm. And so what I like to tell guys, and that's a little bit drastic, right? It's tough to tell a kid who's a 3-point shooter, hey man, this, what you do best mm-hmm. isn't gonna help you all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to do other things. 100%. And so what we try and talk to guys a little bit about, and I say this to my guys all the time, I said, I got a rule of two, all right? Shoot 2 layups, or 2 free throws before you shoot a 3. Then you'll be in the game. Mm-hmm. Then you'll be playing in the game. Mm-hmm. And then play as hard as you possibly can on defense because it will carry over to the other side. Most of the players today think they don't have to play hard on defense, that they can play hard on only one side of the basketball and have good results. And that's fool's gold.
100%.
You've got to play hard on both sides of the basketball if you want to be good on both sides of the basketball because there's carryover. You just can't turn it on into an offensive threat and then think you're going to be going hard. So I always tell my guys, rule of two, you know, mix it up. Get, you know, and it doesn't always work because the game starts and there is open and there you go. I want to hit this 3. This is what coach wants me to do. That's part of it too. But I always tell my guys, mix it up first, then go to the 3 because the success that you have on the free throw line or the layup is going to make you feel better about 100%. Taking that 3.
It's also like, so that day where I shot 0 for 10 or whatever it was coincidentally my best day from everything, not from 3-point range. I had the most, so I've been trying to add to my game this off season adding one dribble, two dribble pull-ups. Yesterday, I was, came to the gym like an hour before open gym, and I was really working on coming off of a screen because I'm everybody in the gym knows, like, I want to shoot. That's what I want to do. And so if we play up to seven and we have 5 points, it's like, don't let Max get the ball open. And so I'm being run off the line, and one of the things I was working on is catching the ball off a screen and then taking one dribble and getting a high pickup over someone's hand reaching in. And yesterday I executed that for the first, like, I've been working on that for a little bit, and yesterday I executed that perfectly for the first time. And I definitely see myself growing in areas other than the three-point shooting, and I feel like that's really important for my game, because if I was going to get put in the game in, like, meaningful minutes for shooting threes, it would have already happened. So I think I'd need to develop my game in other areas like you're talking about in order to make a bigger impact and get better as a player.
You know who else was 0-for? R.J. Davis. The Sweet 16 game. You know who else was? Who was the other guard that was 0-for? The kid Caleb Love from Arizona. Also 0-for. So the thing that I say to people is...
They're also both All-Americans.
Well, this is what I say to people, and it's just, you know, R.J. Davis had a monster year. Mm-hmm. Caleb Love had a monster year. Both of them did. But that day's coming. Mm-hmm. That 0-for-9 day is coming. If you play basketball long enough, that day's coming. Yeah. What happened on that day? Everything else went good. Everything else was solid. Or did it affect you mentally? Did you, create bad body language? Did you take more bad shots because you were trying to force things? Those are the things that matter. And so that day's coming. That's what I try and tell players. Build that foundation around it so when that day comes, you don't get completely blown 100% off the map.
100%. One of the things that I'm curious about, because I came from a really small town in Canada, and I never really got to play in front of crowds, but I've known that New York, and from some of the guys on the podcast, is notorious for their really rowdy crowds in parks and stuff like that. How do you think that that's helpful for players to go out and play in parks and get yelled at and have this super intense environment to develop their game?
Of course. Of course. We went to Nazareth and Babson, two of the different NCAA games that we had had. In Division III, when you go to the NCAA tournament, you don't go neutral a lot of times. You get sent to the home courts, you know, of the
people. We know Nazareth very well.
So we walked into Nazareth, and the place was just unbelievably lit up. You know, I love that. I love that as a player. I love it as a coach. You know, it's a little harder to operate and do your business, you know, but I like that part of it. The other piece of it is, too, when I was younger, you know, there were some places, like, we had a team in our league when I was in grammar school. We couldn't go to their home gym. They had to play in a boys' club that was somewhere else. We couldn't actually go to their block where their boys' club was and play in their gym because it wasn't safe enough. So there's been, you know, times where, you know, the game is very important to a lot of people. I know that. And we just got a perspective is important, too.
A lot of it's also just simulate. Like, I feel like that environment simulates an environment of comparable level of where you're going to that NCAA turn, or you're playing in a park in Harlem where there's crowds and everyone's chirping, and that kind of simulates the going to Nazareth for the first round of the NCAA tournament. And there's parallels in, like, with that and all throughout basketball of, like, trying to prepare yourself the best way possible that will translate towards on-court performance. I think that, like, that's just what I thought of when you said about, like, the crowd and stuff like that. It's like, that's,
I think, one trip to Rucker Park made me a better player. One trip, one game I had done, I was in, we used to call it Rucker, they used to call it Citywide, and so there were all these different places that you had to go to play, and they were intense, you know. But they're also, in those communities, the inner city communities, basketball is religion down there in New York, so they treat it really, really importantly, too. And so if you're a good ball player down there, you're gonna, they're gonna love you. They're gonna treat you well, because that's, it's so important in New York. Like, they have Dykeman now. Mm-hmm. You know, this place in New York now where all the pros come in the summer and they'll mix in with some really good high school guys and college guys, and it's crazy over there. My grandmother lived one block from there when I was growing up. I used to go shoot in that court when I was a kid, and I was the only guy in there for 100 years. Nobody ever played basketball on that court. Now it's one of the most famous courts in New York because everybody goes to Dykeman. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those things. But New York has always been... and yes, I do think it makes you a better player, because if you never experience that and then it happens, you're going to be in trouble. Yeah. You're going to get lit up.
One of the things I'm curious about, because I know it's different for every single coach. Like, last year, our coach really didn't want us to turn the ball over. Like, he was super particular about not turning the ball over. We had a turnover rack, so every time we would turn the ball over, if we got down to, like, zero balls.
Take the ball off and start running.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we've done some of that, too. It gets a little nutty, I do, but I'm not a big fan of it.
Mm-hmm. And that was, like, his pet peeve. So I'm wondering, do you have a specific coaching pet peeve that just irks, like, you when players do
this? For example, another one from our coach at Madai was a jump passing. Like, it's not necessarily jump passing, and it's jumping – it's not jumping to make a pass. It's jumping to find a pass. And then that usually ends up in turnovers. I remember one time I was dribbling the ball. We're getting pressed. And I just left my feet, turned it over, and I had to push the sandbag for the only time. We had this 60-pound sandbag. They had to push their back across the gym if you did something that coach deemed worthy of the sandbag. A couple of people had to do it a couple of times.
That was sandbagged? The only
time. Yeah. I got sandbags yeah. for that.
I stay away from corporal punishment as much as I can because I want my players to, like, as I said, I think I'm a PhD, right? So if I'm not coaching and teaching well, then that's on me. As I say to my players every single year in the locker room, we are 19-7 this year. You guys had 19 wins, and I had 7 losses. I take the heat. It's my job to get the team prepared, and everything that goes wrong with it is my job. Everything that goes right with it is their job. So to me, I think coaches take themselves way too seriously in this whole thing. That creates a bit of a problem as well. But when you're dealing with young men, it's like – we had a video one time they were watching. We used to travel with the women's team. So the women's team puts on a video on the bus when we're going to the game of this high school team that had never won the state tournament out in New Mexico before. And they went on this run and they wound up winning. So they put the coach on and they go to the coach and he says, "Coach, how's it been coaching 30-something years out here?" And he says, "You know, it's funny. I ask my players this one question all the time." He says, "Why did you do that?" And the same answer for 30 years is, "I don't know." And so if that's the answer, then they don't know. They didn't know. I played basketball. I don't know. So in terms of your turnover question, in terms of your mistakes, John Wooden said the team that turns the ball over the most is the team that's going to win because you're playing freely and you're taking chances. I don't like unforced turnovers, but if somebody's running the floor and I got a guy, my big man, I'm trying to get him running the floor and he goes out and he runs it and the point guard sees him, throws it, and it goes just a little too far, they're not going to hear a word from me. We'll clap that mistake up because that's one of the things we start doing on our benches. We clap for mistakes. Body language is important. Vibration is important. We clap for mistakes. Now, we get in somebody that comes in and he goes behind his back 32 times at half court and then dribbles it right off his ankle. You know, that's a little different. That's unforced, you know. But in the course of basketball, it's just like – it is with some of you young guys now with everybody wanting to police language. Mm-hmm. You know, once you start doing that, you create this vibration that's you're not going to get free communication from people. Mm-hmm. Same thing with coaching. Once you start policing turnovers and all that other stuff, you're not going to get that free exchange into basketball. People are not going to want to take chances. For sure. And I want a team that's willing to take a chance once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, like, it's a part of your program, part of a building a basketball program is also the culture that surrounds it. And here at Elms, we have a few, like, for example, we have team game night every other Wednesday, or we have this thing called the belt, not in a negative way, in a positive way. You get this like WWE championship belt with Elms College for like the person who's done the best this week, whether it's practice or games or whatever. Do you have any? And we have a bunch of other ones too that are not coming to mind right now. We had a couple at Medai as well. Is there anything that you have added to your team's culture? I guess that's kind of something like that, like a little nuance.
Yeah, you know, we've always done a little bit of, you know, I like to have them at my home mm-hmm. when we can do that. Like to take them out to restaurants, you know, so they can get out with that as well. But I'm big into cake. Cake. I go to this place called Pasticceria out on Route 57. They have the best chocolate cakes. They got these big monster cakes. So if we're playing well, somebody took charges, maybe it's somebody's birthday, it's, you know, one of those things. I like to bring in a big old cake, and we just slice that up during film.
Awesome.
So
that's awesome.
I'm a big cake person, but I also I think it's important that we do things that are, like, for example, you get to February, and you've got a game in 2 days, mm-hmm. but they're fried. They're really worn out. They're really tired. What I might do then, instead of, you know, having cake or a game night or something like that, I might take 35 to 40 minutes of my practice schedule and throw it in the garbage, bring the trainers in and have them stretch, do holistic different things with them to make them start to feel a little better that way. Mm-hmm. So that with me as a coach, I'm looking at my group and my assistant coach is going, "Coach, we got home late last night. They're just absolutely fried. I don't know what you're going to get out of them today." Mm-hmm. Okay, get the trainers in here. Let's get them stretched out. Let's get them feeling better. Let's open up the ice baths. Let's get all that good stuff going. And then we'll maybe do some stuff at the end of practice where we might try and get something done. But you got to really, really know as a coach, I liken it to two things. I'm a race car driver, and I got to know how far to put my foot down on a pedal, or I'm a person who's a chef, and I got to know how to turn that burner up and turn it down and have it at the right temperature. That's, for me, is important. The right temperature, correct temperature is important.
The majority of our audience is high school kids and middle school basketball players. And so I want to try and provide some value to them coming from you. And I want to know, what is the most important skill a high school player or a middle school player you think could develop in order to become a successful college basketball player?
Shooting.
Seems to be a very common answer.
Shooting. Yep. You can really improve it. And everybody's looking for it these days because there's so much of a European trend in basketball right now where there's space in the floor and they're having a lot of three-ball shots. You would have told me years ago that 35 three-point shots are going to be taken in a game. I would have said, you're crazy, and now it's average. You know, it's the norm. So people are looking for different things in that to fill as well. So I think shooting's really, really important. And then, you know, the only way to move with the ball in our game is dribbling. You know, and those two things you can really improve and get better at. And one of the things I would encourage people to do, because I have some really fast players, and when you put the basketball in their hand, they slow down considerably. And so, and then you have other players who aren't really going to win any sprints, but then you put the ball in their hands and they move like really well and quick, and they're like chess players. They can see the next move ahead of them. So I look at a lot of different things when I'm looking at that whole thing as well. But you want to just really, really approach it, you know, from the player's benefit perspective. What's best for them? That's what I try and come out. Every formula, that's what I try and come out. What's best for them?
This is a bit more of a personal question, but do you have kids?
Yes, I do.
Has having children affected the way you coach or vice versa?
Well, my daughter Jordan comes to every single game. She sits behind the bench, sometimes right behind our bench. And so you have to be careful with what you say when you have an 8-year-old behind your bench, a 7-year-old behind your bench. But it made me absolutely into a better person, though. I don't know if it made me a better coach. Probably did, but I don't know if it did or it didn't. But it absolutely made me into a better person. And that was, and from that respect of being responsible for somebody else is just incredible. And we had one of the worst losses of my career. And I came home. It was a playoff game. We got blasted. Absolutely blasted. Say goodbye to seniors, their last game.
This was
rough.
This was this season?
No. This was 19 years ago, 20 years ago. And then I come home, and we had this tiny little condominium right off a golf course, and my wife would never be up after games. Like, we're getting home at midnight, you know. She'd never be up after games. She'd be asleep. I'd, you know, go in and try not to wake her up. You know, then she's up. She comes over to the top of the stairs and looks and says, "You're going to be a dad." And got blasted that night. So one of the worst games of my career. And then come home and say, okay, you're going to be a dad. And then all of a sudden you say, holy smokes, man. What are you thinking about here? Where's your perspective? You know? 100%. And so that, it absolutely made me. But it also, it made life better.
100%.
Life better. You, a lot of you young people that are looking at you right now and they're, I don't know if I want to be a parent. I don't know if I want to do this. First off, that's the only way we keep the planet moving, folks.
That's the okay, we need people. Ultimate, that's the ultimate goal of humanity is to
It should be. It should be. We're in a little different place right now, I think. But I can say to all of you young people that watch this podcast and to anybody else who would be listening, it's one of the defining and seminal moments of your life. It absolutely is.
Not yet, though, for you young people. You gotta
not yet.
Get
not
to college yet. Basketball, have a good career, yeah. Get a job, and then.
But
then
one of the things that you two have learned in your experience in basketball, and we'll say it to all the young guys out there, you're learning how not to quit. You're learning how to persevere. You're learning how to make yourself better. You're learning how to change things when they don't go right. And so those are important skills. And they have worked well with me in marriage as well, too, because if you get married, you're going to have to be able to shift and change and move your game plan from time to time and up your game and do all sorts of different things. So basketball is a really, really good entry for me into marriage, believe it or not, because especially the coaching piece of it is, you know, you really, really got to be able to up your game. You really got to take it to that next level.
So one of the things that we talk about a lot on this podcast pretty consistently is how basketball is a very good segue to life, and the lessons that you learn through the trials and tribulations of a basketball career and the ups and downs really prepare you for challenges after basketball, or just in completely, there's transferable skills that basketball learns, whether it's perseverance, whether it's commitment, whether it's delayed gratification, there's all these things. So I'm just curious, what are some things that basketball has taught you that you've brought into your personal life?
Yeah, that's a great question, because it really impacted it, like, amazingly. Mm-hmm. You know, because, like, when you're on the line running sprints and you want to just, like, quit, you want to stop, and your coach is sitting down there with the whistle and he blows it again and again, and you're sitting there and you just don't want to go anymore, Once you get out of that gym, though, and you went that further distance, you know you went further than you ever went before. You know you went to a place that you couldn't get to, and you let your coach take you there. And that's important as well. And that's one of the things you're talking about, marriage. You have to let that other person take you to that spot as well. And so that's what coaching does, and that's what marriage does, is it helps you take you to that spot you could have never gotten on your own. And so with that power that a coach has, you got to wield it, and you got to be smart about it. You got to be really careful about it, because it is power, and you got to be smart with it.
One of the things that I often hear when talking to basketball players, and it's usually jokingly, but they talk about, like, they're going to force their kid to play basketball. My kid has to play basketball. He's going to the league, all this stuff. Do you want your kids to play basketball or any sport in general?
My daughter's 19. She's a freshman at Westfield right now. Never picked up a basketball in her life, and she's a theater person like her mom. And, you know, I didn't put any pressure on her to play sports at all. She's pretty good at some different things, you know, but never really took into that competitive stuff. You know, when I grew up, I would compete over anything. I had that in me, you know. And then when I watched my daughter, I saw clearly that she did not, you know. And so I could instill it, or I could do that. I let her take me where she wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And that was the beauty of it. And to be honest with you, I'm really glad she didn't take up basketball, because I get enough of it every single day with my players and all the drama around that stuff, and then go home and watch the Big East and the ACC and all the other good stuff, NBA on after that. You know, I was kind of happy, because it really does impact your family and your life in a really kind of critical way. I remember being with my family when we were younger, going off to all the games my brother had and all this. So I loved it, but it's a lot, you know, and then the pressure that comes with it. You know, you see Coco Gauff and some of the young tennis players and one-on-one sports and stuff like that. They're having a lot of time dealing with the mental aspect of it and the pressure aspect of it. So I never wanted to put my daughter into that forum where it would be like, okay, you know, this is like hard to handle.
Yeah.
You know,
I
think that happens with a lot of these young people. And so if she wanted it, I was there and I'm ready to go. But if not, I'm not pushing and I'm not going that way.
You were talking about how you had that terrible loss 19 years ago, and then you found out you were a father that night, and everything kind of changed. That kind of took the weight off of basketball. Something else that we talk about a lot is having things outside of basketball to help that give you happiness, so that when you go to practice and you don't make a shot, you turn the ball over, coach yells at you, all these negative things, and now you go back to your dorm where you just moved away. I moved 8-hour drive from home, and I'm here to play basketball, and basketball wasn't messing with me today. What do you have? What other pillars do you have to help give you happiness, so you're not just sitting with your thoughts? And so something I'm curious for you is, other than family, do you have any hobbies or stuff like that that you lean to when you said you were 19-7 this year? So when you give up a game or when things aren't going right?
I'm fairly fanatical about golf.
Okay.
I coach the men's golf team at Westfield.
Really?
And I also play quite a bit. I'm fairly fanatical about that, more than I should be. But my personality is like that. Whenever I do something, I just want to, you know. But I think, you know, when you say family, that for me is because I spend so much time away from them, mm-hmm. that I have to really, that's the focus when I have that time. So I'm going to spend all of that time there. But I really love to read. You know, if I don't have 2 books a month down, then I'm not doing a good job in that vein. I like to read. I love crossword puzzles. I love doing a crossword puzzle, keep my brain unscrambled.
What type of books do you like to read?
I never read anything that's not true. Or at least that they say isn't true. You know, I'm big into books where I can learn. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't read like a Jean Le Carre novel or one of those spy novels that aren't true. You know, they tell you, oh, he's in Germany and we're, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not interested in that. I just read a book on Bill Gates, you know, and his foundation and all the other stuff that's tied in with that. I thought that was real. I just want to learn when I read. So it just, and that's one of the only things during basketball season that helps me sleep.
Yeah.
Is actually reading it.
I'm not a big reader at all, but my dad was just at a work convention and he met the author of this book.
Train Like an Olympian.
It's called Train Your Brain Like an Olympian. He sees it beside my bed every day. I've just blanked on what the book was called, but I've started picking up, I guess, reading, which is kind of crazy for me to say out loud because I'm so not someone that would necessarily do that, but I'm committing to read 5 pages every night before bed. And I definitely feel like it's helped me fall asleep, but I also feel like just learning and just ending the day off with learning strategies of how to strengthen your mental game or different strategies that will help you in situations like we've talked about in this podcast has really been beneficial for me.
And listening and talking to other people's lives, experiences and stuff like that sometimes resonates with you as well.
For sure.
Wow, I didn't know that happened with Michael Jordan. I didn't know Michael Jordan got cut, you know, when he was in high school. I didn't know that, you know, Shaquille O'Neal's dad was a military guy. You know, there's a lot of things. And when you read books, you really get into the whole structure of the person and the way that the whole thing is. But I like, you know, I taught history when I first got a high school history teacher. So I love history and I love stuff like that. But I want it to be true. I want to, if I read a book, I don't want, it's nonfiction, right? You know, and fiction.
Chris has 45 books on his dresser, like 48 of them, or 38 of them that are nonfiction. So,
what's your favorite book?
There's a few. So Mike Tyson's biography, I absolutely love that. I forget exactly what it's called, but basically it breaks down his how he got into fighting. Like one of the main things was like he was getting bullied and he had these pigeons that he used to keep. He was from a really broke neighborhood and he didn't grow up with a lot of money. But
he was from the Bronx.
Yeah. And he had these pigeons that he used to keep at the top of an apartment. And this was like one of the places as a kid he found really true happiness. And he was getting bullied. And one of the kids managed to get a hold of one of his pigeons. And he was like, give me my pigeon back. And he was like yelling at this kid. And the kid took the pigeon, twisted the head off and threw it at him. And this is the first fight he'd ever been in. And they made him, everyone like surrounded him, made him fight this kid. And he said, in that moment, that's when he became Mike Tyson. And Iron Mike came out. And then he just started, you go on this huge journey where he met these people and all these things happened backwards. That's one of them. Another one's probably David Goggins, Can't Hurt Me. He sort of breaks down. He used to run on broken legs and all this crazy shit from the military and all that. Another one I'm currently rereading.
I do 4 pull-ups and I'm ready to fall off the bar. He's 17 hours on a pull-up bar. And I don't know if I can believe that one, but David Goggins, he's great.
He also grew up in a rough neighborhood. He grew up, actually, it's crazy, at Madai. His house was 10 minutes away from the school, like the original bluff. Yeah, and I was going to go drive to it, but I never actually got around to
it. Like where he currently lives?
Where he grew up. And he had a lot of damaging memories there. But and then I'm currently rereading Jordan Peterson's 10 Rules for Life. I like that one a lot. There's another one by Neil Strauss. It's called I can't remember exactly what it's called. But basically, it's this guy. He was like a 21-year-old virgin. He wasn't having much success with women, and he goes in this online forum, and he manages to find himself in this super secret group of seducers. And then he writes. He was a writer at the time, and he ends up being like one of the best seducers in the world over the course of 5 years. And it's just a crazy story. But there's a lot of books. Interesting. I read a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
but,
it's good. Books are fun. Books are fun.
One of the things I am curious about, though, is because I have conversations with a lot of older people, like my dad and stuff, and one of the themes I've noticed is like when they're looking back on their lives, they usually explain things in terms of like you can't explain the dots going forward, only backwards. So I'm wondering if you have any like events that seemed insignificant at the time but ended up actually changing the trajectory of your life.
That's just what I said, actually.
Wow. That's a deep question. So I had a grammar school basketball coach. His name was Danny Monahan, and he was the greatest guy in the world. I loved him to death, and everybody in our neighborhood loved him to death. And he was the first person that ever turned to me and said, do you want to be great? Not do you want to be good? Do you want to be something? You know, this is New York. This is the real deal, fellas. Do you want to be great? And he was the first guy that ever asked me that question. And so every year before the school year would start, when we got into high school, after playing for him in grammar school, he would take us over to this sporting goods store called Hijinks. And you'd get a pair of Chuck Taylors over there if you were with him for $10 when they were normally $15. So every basketball season, we got to go get our Chucks, load up with Danny in his car, and we go over to Hijinks on Jerome Avenue in the Bronx. This time, he had died of a brain aneurysm when he was 26 years old, 28 years old, as I mentioned to you guys before. And back then, they didn't have all the technology they had now to try and make that work. So he was having blackouts at different times. One time we would run in Van Cortlandt Park, and all of the team was down there, and we turned around, and he was face down in a puddle, and he was having an aneurysm seizure. And so when coming home from Hijinks, I was bad day to call a shotgun, because I wound up in the front seat. Two of my friends are in the back seat, and he had a seizure on the Henry Hudson Parkway when we were going about 60 miles an hour. I'm in the front seat, and I'm 15. No driver's license. Never been behind the wheel of a car in my life. And he was just, hands just froze on the wheel. I could see, I had seen him in a seizure before, and I knew it was starting, but then I'm like, we're driving. You know, he's driving. So I don't know what happened, you know, in between that. We hit the guardrail. I grabbed control of the wheel, but he was pulling on it hard. I wound up crashing into a car that was on the right side of us on the highway, pulled it again, came off the other side, went up over the embankment of the highway onto a side street where we wound up stripping the gears of the car and finally getting it to stop. We just missed getting crushed by a New York City bus that was coming the opposite way. And so you say, what did you learn there? You know, well, the first thing you learn is you better think quick And that helped me as a coach, because when it comes down to 3-2-1 and there's 4 seconds left on the clock, everybody looks to me to make that really fast decision. I got 30 seconds. I got 60 seconds. I got to make a quick decision. And so that day in that car, I didn't have no option. I didn't have no shot. It made me understand that no matter what's going on around you, make that right decision, go and make the right play. And that was what I thought was the right play, was just trying to grab the wheel out of his hands and get us over to the side of the road where we could. Thankfully, none of us got hurt. He passed away 4 or 5 months after that. But in that moment, I also learned that people were telling us not to get in the car with him before he passed away. Adults, they had seen the seizures. They knew what was going on. They were talking to him, you know, don't put the kids in your car, or you don't know what's going on. We don't know it. So there was that little bit of it. And then he pulled me aside one day and he told me what was going on with him. You want to tell a whole lot of people. He told me. And so I got back in the car that day out of loyalty. I got back in the car that day because I was never going to leave my guy alone. And that's something we learn when we grow up in the Bronx. You don't ever turn on your own people. You stay with them. And that was dangerous that day. And we could have died that day. But I learned that day also, you don't ever turn your back on people. You don't ever run from people. You stay there. It's hard. It sucks. And at 16 years old, I lost him. And that's why I became a basketball coach. But I never ran, and I never turned from him. And that's why I can look myself in a mirror these days.
I was going to say, so we got to wrap it up relatively soon because my computer's dying like crazy.
Well, I got a few more before we do that. Like, yeah. I was going to go into, so that was pretty much, that was a brush with mortality. And I've seen in my life a few people who've had a brush with death, and that really changes the way that they look at life. And even like growing up in a small country town, like there's crazy shit can happen. Like I saw people lose their arms and on the farm and shit like that. And I'm wondering, did that change the way you, like, did you feel more pressure to do things in your life now that you've had this really close brush with death, even at 15?
I was 16. I was still playing high school basketball. And then when he passed away that following year, it was right at the start of basketball season. And so it impacted me for the rest of my life. I wanted to be like him. I wanted to be able to say to people, do you want to be great? That's what I wanted. And to help them get to that next step. So that's what I was really looking to do. The way the whole thing went down with him, that impacted my life 100%. It made me a better person. Mm-hmm. It made me a stronger person. It was a lot to go through in order to get there, but it was worth it.
Mm-hmm. So a few more things before we have to wrap it up.
I think we could just pause this and just use the rest of the recording from the rest of the audio.
I don't want to do that. I'd rather just get good audio. But for a few things, do you have any advice you would give to a younger coach that's just starting out in their coaching career?
Learn your craft. So many coaches now get caught up in all of these other ancillary things like recruiting, and they can be a really good recruiter and sign this player and sign that player. At the end of the day, you're going to be the guy that stands in that huddle with the clipboard in your hand, and you're going to have to know what you're talking about. I watch some of the coaches that come on today, you know, and you look at when you see John Shire at Duke, you see Hubert Davis at North Carolina. There were a lot of resumes in the country that might have been stronger than theirs for the job, but they went ahead and gave them the job as well. I watch them on the sidelines, and I sit there and I go, you know. So there's these little things that I kind of notice and pick up on, but for the most part of it, at any young coach, I would turn them, learn the craft. Learn the craft. And that came from me as a JV basketball coach in a Catholic high school league in New York.
Another thing we talk about this podcast a lot is some crazy college basketball stories. So like the welcome to college moment or some crazy stuff that happened to them during their time playing basketball. Do you have any crazy college basketball stories?
Nah, just when I was at St. Bonaventure, we got to bring up a bunch of really good recruits. And a lot of my job was bringing them back and forth to the hotel and everything like that. So we were fortunate to get this young man named Olden Polonese to visit. He was a young man that I had coached in high school. When I went to Bonaventure, one of the reasons I went to Bonaventure is because they were hoping that I could bring Polonese up there with me for a visit at least. So we wound up getting him a visit. Before his visit came, he went to the University of Virginia with a guy named Bruce Dalrymple, Tommy Sheehy, a bunch
tough
of Kenny follow-up. Smith,
Very
Kenny the Smith
follow-up.
Jet. Okay, and they picked him up in a private jet. And they drove him from New York all the way down to the University of Virginia with all of his boys on there. They have Tommy Sheehy, who was from Rochester, who says, oh, I like chicken wings. They turned the plane around and went to Rochester to buy chicken wings, then took them down to Virginia. So we have them visiting the next day, next weekend. And my head coach, Jim O'Brien, sitting there, and he's like, man, I knew they were going to do something. You know, they sent the plane for him, you know, a private plane. These guys are all young kids on a private plane, you know, and they're all being recruited at the University of Virginia. And now we got to try and top that the next week. And we're at St. Bonaventure. St. Bonaventure was 70 miles from the Buffalo airport. One of the reasons I had as much import there as I did is I went and got all these guys at the airport and drove them back and forth. So I spent time with Mark Jackson, with Olden Polynice, with all these guys. We said, I don't want them in the car for 70 minutes. I don't want them in the car for 70 minutes. All right, what are we going to do? We're going to fly them from the Buffalo airport up to Allegheny Airport, which was right next to St. Bonaventure. I'm like going, hey, fellas, I don't know about you, but I don't really like to fly that much. Could one of you guys go down and get them this time? Said, he's your guy. You got to go get him. If you don't go, it's not going to look good. So I'm like, okay, I'll go down. We'll get him. I turn around, and we're getting into like a puddle jumper. We're getting into like a one prop plane with a guy who's like, if you've ever seen the movie Old School. Okay, the movie. Go look at the movie Old School. They have a character in that movie called Blue. He's like 100 years old, and this dude is driving
it's
our
like,
plane.
It's like, what's the dude from our teacher from Madai, the...
Oh, Pacheco?
Yeah. Is it, this guy's like 100, yeah. And he's driving our plane. So it's me and a McDonald's All-American, Olden Polynice, who I coached, and we're strapped up in this little one little pilot thing. And I said, I'm not sure it was going to top UVA's private jet that they had. We got him up to campus. It was a good visit and everything like that. But that was, you know, we were floating around Western New York in this little puddle jumper, and I was hoping we just landed. But not too many crazy ones.
Looking back on your 20-year career, do you have any big mistakes that you made early on or even throughout the rest of your career that you could help other coaches avoid making?
Every day. Every day. Every day I make
mistakes.
Everybody
makes mistakes every day.
Every day I write the book, as Elvis Costello said. For younger coaches, it's Nelson Mandela's quote. I'll leave with them. I never lose. I win and I learn. I never lose. And so every loss, everything that you have, or if a kid transfers or you didn't get along with, you know, they're all learning tools. Take every one of them as a learning experience and a tool, and you'll be fine. If you start to personalize it, you're going to be in a fetal position and you're not going to have fun and you're not going to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You got to take it in as everything's a learning tool. And so that's what I would say to everybody is with everything in life, you know, you don't lose, you just learn.
I think we're ready to wrap it up.
So, we have a kind of signature question that we ask all of our guests before we wrap it up, and it's just, what's one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self?
One piece of advice I would give to my younger self, save your money. Save your money.
What would you do if you saved your money?
I'd be retired.
Okay. Would you still be coaching?
Yeah, probably. That's the thing that I'm up against now. You know, how much longer? You know, but I feel really good. So I don't think that, like, age-wise, they say retirement's in the future, but, like, I feel pretty good, so I don't see how that could possibly happen anytime soon.
Yeah,
so
actually, we kind of can parlay that to one last question, which is just, if you stop coaching today, what would your life look like? What would you be doing? I mean, you're ready to wrap it up.
I want to keep doing my podcast. Mm-hmm. I would love to get into being able to do some color for basketball games, live games, mm-hmm. do color, do something like that. Or, God, if I got lucky, you know, in the zone, got picked up by Outkick or somebody like that, I would do something like that. Mm-hmm. But when I'm done, I'm going to be hopefully done, you know, and I want to go all the way till I'm done. You know, like we talked about 369 victories. What does that look like? Do I go to 400? Do I go to 500? That's about it in that frame, but 500 might be nice, you know? So I try not to treat it like that. I treat it like as I'm still enjoying it. And right now I'm having a blast. So
awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.